Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Wesley and broadcast through the Community Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. This is Listen to Older Voices, and I'm your host, Rob Greaves. Thank you for joining me for the third and final part of the story of John Hanley. Born in the rock and roll decade of the 1950s, we've learned that John came from a talented family and how music has played a constant part throughout his life. Yet, we've also learned that there are many faces to John. He's been an engineer. He became a third Dan black belt and has taken every opportunity to explore life to its fullest. In this program, John talks about how he picked up from a messy and traumatic divorce with the help and support of parents and kids who were attending his martial arts classes, as well as how he fell back on music to help both heal himself and to help him refocus. We learn, to our amazement, that John is also an accomplished skydiver and has won many awards. We learn how he met his current wife Amanda and how they have forged a wonderful personal and working partnership. John has built up a fully functioning workshop where he works on high-end cars and motorcycles, which in turn helps fund his many pursuits. John's also an inventor, and he shares stories of projects current and in the planning, including the desire to make a flying motorcycle. After you hear this story, I think you'll believe he will succeed. Incidentally, the snoring you hear during the latter part of our talk is courtesy of one of John's dogs. We pick up now with John talking about the trauma of the divorce involving his first wife.
Then I got divorced while I had all these schools going and everything, and she caused me no end of trouble. Just absolutely, it was a nightmare, the trouble she caused. And I've just gone, reassess. So I called all the parents in of the kids' class that I had, explained everything to them that was going on. One of them was the principal of one of the local state schools, and he wrote me this massive glowing letter about how I'd brought these children, the quiet ones had been brought out of their shell and had the confidence to work within the school and with other kids now, whereas the ones that the rowdy ones that they were having all these trouble with now were so better behaved and controlled. So, you know, and they would listen to what was being told. And so I had these all these great letters and everything, and as good as they were, it was still a lot of me to process that with the time with the divorce and lawyers and all that sort of stuff. So
it's a lot going on.
Yeah, so I shut everything down with that and just, again, continued with the music. And at the time, the girl I was married to, she was the one, she told me, I got to sell my parachute, I got to sell my hot rod, and I got to sell my guitars and my motorbike.
She's making this demand.
Oh, she wanted me to wear a suit. And, yeah. I did sell the car, I did sell the motorbike. I kept one guitar. I refused to sell anything else. I kept one guitar. And I've still got that guitar today.
Okay, that's a lot to process as a listener. That's a lot to process. But I will pick up on one thing you said. You talked about I had to sell the parachute.
I was a skydiver when I was living up in Auburn.
Oh, here we go. Okay, we're not going to let you get away with that one, John. How did that all come about?
I was working with a guy, and he came into work one day, and his wife had bought him a birthday present of a skydive.
You were working as what, sorry?
It was in the very first time that they'd brought polypropylene film into Australia in the Southern Hemisphere, and they built this brand new factory.
So you were there as an engineer of some
form? Yeah, I was one of them. There was four shift engineers and I was one of them.
Right, and he bought in this, what did you sell?
It was just one of the guys I was working with. Yeah. His wife bought him for his birthday a skydiving thing. And I'm going skydiving. I said, I wouldn't mind doing that myself. So I went along with him. We did all the pre-training, all the everything that we had to do. And the next thing you know, I'm in a plane and they're throwing me out.
Okay, whoa, that's a big metaphorical jump, both actually physically jumping and getting to that point. I mean, what sort of training did you have to do to get to that point?
Back then, it was fairly basic. 44-gallon drum, you stood on the top of it and jumped off.
Oh, you're kidding. No, you're kidding.
No, I'm not.
It was your training, yeah. And on the basis of that, well, you got in a plane and jumped?
What you were taught was
falling,
ankles, knees together, and it was land, and then you went ankles, knees, hip, opposite shoulder. That roll? Was the roll. That was the parachute roll. Right. That's what they teach in the army. You were basically taught how to land.
I'm very rarely caught short of words, John, but that one has absolutely stunned me. So let's take you back. Here's this plane taking off for the first time. You're in it. The very first time you've got parachutes strapped to your back. Whereabouts are you in Victoria?
Burrumbuttick, which is about 30 kilometres west of Albury.
Okay. You're up at a certain height, and I've got to show my goodness, I have no idea what height you have to be at.
The static line ones were all done at around about 2,500 feet.
And you're on a static line?
Yep.
Okay. So this is your first time, and is it a big plane or is it a little plane?
A Cessna 180. Which tail dragger.
A tail dragger. Okay. So there's two of you in there or just one?
There was
you?
A pilot. He had a seat. You unbolted the other seat.
It's just the two of you and the pilot.
No. That we had four people.
And you are which number in that four?
Oh, I was
in
number first.
You were first.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to go. Well, what they taught you to do was that you'd reach out. It was an above-wing aircraft with a strut underneath. You'd reach out, you'd grab
the strut,
grab the other strut, and you'd be hanging off the strut. Just looking in at the pile at the other guy, and then he would say, go, and you had to just let go.
You had no qualms?
No, it was fine.
John, I think there are a lot of people listening at the moment who probably in my shoes are going, and excuse me, folks, if I use this word, holy shit. You're on a plane, you're thousands of feet above the ground, and you're holding this strut, and they say go, and you just let go.
Well, I could actually give you probably a whole story about some of the things
I've
been
through. Please do. We've got the time. Well, go for it. And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning back time. Turning back time. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with John Handley, and John is relating some of his skydiving stories.
I'd only done five jumps, all on static line, and then I was allowed to do the full ripcord thing myself. So you had to count, do the this, lean back, go through the motions, everything. Once you'd proven on the ground that you could do it and everything, then they let you jump out by yourself. I get out on my number six jump, ready, set, by now, I'm an old hand. Easy. Like anyone can do this. Get out, pull the ripcord. Nothing.
Oh,
looked over my shoulder and there was this bag of just rags hanging above me, all tangled and knotted up.
Oh, no.
And I'm plummeting down to
work. Yeah, you're plummeting, that's right.
Once you hit terminal, you're at about 120 mile an hour. So I'm plummeting down, I've looked at it and I've gone, that doesn't look right. So I've just gone, cut away, open the reserve, boom, it's opened up. And then I'm trying to steer it because there wasn't a steering on the reserve ones like there is in the mains.
That.
So I've got the reserve opened up. And straight into a tree.
Oh, I don't know where to take this because I'm still plummeting with you at the moment. You obviously are not a man who panics then.
Nah.
Because, I mean, it's easy for us to sit here on a couch and go, oh, yeah, I wouldn't panic either. But when you're plummeting, most people would be going, ah, oh, was it your training in terms of parachute jumping or just the nature of who you are?
I think it's just in general how I've been. I've got to that stage in life where I'd been frightened, I'd been scared, I'd been pushed, I'd been bullied, I'd been everything, but I'd overcome them all.
Yeah.
And I just look at them now and go, I don't care how big you are, I don't care who you are, I'll speak nicely to you, but you want to take the first punch, it's your own fault.
Well, I'm not going to. So here you are, you get this jerk because it takes, and there must have been a moment of relief.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that it's actually worked.
Because I didn't have a third one.
No, that's right. You don't know. This is it. You have no control over it because, as you said, and I didn't know this, you have no controlling. What are they actually? Are they called guide ropes?
Well,
or what are they actually
called?
All
you can do is you can grab three or four of the cords on one side, and it spills air out. So
yeah,
it spins around.
Goes in that direction.
These are the old round ones.
Oh.
Not the square ones.
God, okay.
So I've had to steer this round, and round ones. It's like, you know, steering a bus on a lake.
Okay. You know? So you're steering in terms only, not really steering all that well.
No.
And what, into a tree?
Yeah, well, just sort of into the tree.
The branches or the actual trunk?
Oh, in the branches. And the parachute got hung up in the branches, so I was just left hanging there. So I had to come down. We got it down. And
Well, so we got it down.
Oh, the other guys that were on the ground.
They found you.
Yeah, yeah. I was only 100 yards away from where I was supposed to land.
Oh, that's pretty damn good then, given you had so little control. Yeah. Was that your last jump?
No, I went on to have over 500 jumps. I've got Australian titles and Victorian titles in accuracy and all sorts of things.
I sit here, John, and it's hard not to admit I'm in awe. Most of us do things in our lives that we're very proud about and we take some risks. That's a pretty incredible...
Really, like, the amount of people that die from skydiving is 1% of the people that die in bus crashes. Getting on a bus is far more dangerous than jumping out a plane. And here's a little bit of information that you might find amusing. My very first skydive was also my very first plane ride. And I had done...
And that's in this little Cessna.
Yeah. And I'd done 100 plane rides and never landed in a plane.
That's a record that's probably hard to beat.
And at one stage there, they said, oh, we're going to have to land. We can't do this. I said, no, I'm getting out. I said, I can't break the record. And I trusted getting out more than I trusted the pilot landing.
Wow. That's a really good story, John. That's a very, very good story. Why did you stop?
Oh, I moved back down to Melbourne and...
Life moved on.
Yeah. Other things took control and, you move back on to other things and priorities take their advantage.
Of course they do. Of course they do. So, okay, you mentioned about the fact that you were married and very sadly it didn't work out and you got divorced.
Yeah.
But you seem to be happily married now. How did you meet your current wife?
Well, during that period where I just didn't want to work for anybody, I signed up with a couple of those agencies where you do a day here or a week there or whatever, And they sent me down to where Amanda's working.
And where was that?
Dulux, down in Dandenong.
A paint manufacturer?
Yeah.
Sorry, what kind of work were you looking for at Dulux?
I didn't care.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so it wasn't as an engineer. No. It was just whatever was available.
I would just pack lines or do whatever, drive a forklift. It didn't matter.
Okay.
It was just something to fill in my days before I could go back and play on the weekend.
Okay, you're in the same workplace, but how did you actually make contact with Dulux?
Well, she's the boss.
Oh, you fell in love with the boss.
She's the supervisor.
She was the supervisor.
Yeah, but she wouldn't give me the time of day. She was so quiet and reserved and, So I used to try to talk to her and she'd keep her mouth, very quiet. Yeah. And at lunchtime, we'd sit on the same table and one of the other girls that's still working there today and another guy who's no longer working there but he's still a friend of ours, he came around last week with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And, the four of us would sit at the table. And I'd look across at Amanda and I'd go,
man.
So, how are you going? You're going to talk to me today? And she wouldn't, she was like such a quiet, shy person. And eventually we started going out. One thing led to another.
Well, I was going to say, Amanda, you've described her as quiet and fairly reserved. And yet when we listen back to your story, you are not quiet. You are not reserved. You're almost the opposite. So how did this connection?
This is where it works perfectly because... In the time we've been together, which is now just over 20 years, and we're not married, we've just always been together.
Yeah, that's irrelevant.
As far as I'm concerned, she's my wife. But in that time, I've brought her out of her shell, so now she does tell me off, she does speak her mind, she does seem, and she's more talkative and she's a lot more friendly, whereas she's reined me in a little bit, which is probably a good thing.
Well, I have to say to people listening, I have met and I have spoken with Amanda, and I would never have picked her the way you described her when you first met her. Well done, Amanda, because I think this sounds like, 20 years. I think any couple that make 20 years have got something going.
Yeah, and I couldn't get her to say more than two words if we went to a gig, She was just, she'd sit in the corner, she'd be very quiet, wouldn't do anything. And now, she walks around, talks to people at the table, she's very friendly. And at one stage there, she always said she would never, ever get up on stage. I dressed her up in an Elvis costume with a wig, mask on and the whole thing. And a big New Year's Eve, we had about 400 and something people there. And she got up and she was dancing on stage while I was singing.
Good for you both. That's all I can say. Yeah,
The two of us have sort of worked really well.
Yeah. And for all of you who are listening, if you can hear some snoring going on in the background, it's one of John's dogs who's laying next to me, having a wonderful time being asleep.
Yeah, this old Gizmo.
Yeah, old Gizmo.
Listen to Older Voices. The magic of memories.
There are so many stories I think that you've probably got to tell, John, and we're starting to unpeel some of who you are. When I walked into your place, the first thing you said to me was, come down the back, because everybody does. And when I walked into the back, I walked into this quite well-set-up engineering workshop. What's all that about?
Well, I do all the hydroblasting and preparation and cleaning of all the parts for all the high-end cars, low-end cars, bikes, machinery, you name it. There's, I got one little old lady that comes around every now and again, and I clean her cake tins for her.
I'm sorry, that's a great little story to laugh at. But that workshop is not set up for cleaning cake tins.
No.
You talk about you do all this work on high-end cars. Again, for people listening, what sort of work do you do and how did this all come about?
They'll bring me all the engine components, suspension, all the little bracketry, any little bit to do with steering, you name it, all the little parts. And I do a lot of stuff for all the Ferrari guys, the Porsche, Lamborghini, the Maseratis. All the Holden Ford guys as well. Then, you know, I get all the Mini Cooper S guys come in, all the Jag guys coming in, Mercedes, you know, all these ones bringing stuff. Then I get all the Vincent guys and all the Honda and Kawasaki. And
so what is it, repair work or is it modification or is it both?
Some of it's modification. Some of it's because, you know, something's bent or broken so I have to repair it or do something to it because they want it to be back to original.
Right.
Other times it's just, it's had 50 years of dirt and crap on it.
Right.
So I've cleaned it all up, get it back to bare metal, set it all up so that it's all done. We re-weld all the fins on, make sure everything's right, and send it off. It's powder-coated, it's painted, it's zinc-plated, chromed, do whatever has to be done to it.
How long have you been doing this, roughly?
This is about 11, 12 years now.
So this is a very viable business for you.
Yeah, but I set it up originally as a retirement business.
Oh, okay, we've heard that story before. Yeah,
all
right.
I wanted to do was a couple of days a week. That'll pay the bills so I can go out and play with my own toys.
It didn't work out like it that, just, quite, did it?
Yeah, it just went ballistic. Within 3 months, I was doing 7 days a week. Within 6 months, I was working 10, 12-hour days.
How's this all come about? I mean, do you advertise? Is this one of these things where somebody does such a good job, it's word of mouth?
When I first started, we started advertising. We put a couple of ads in some car and bike magazines, got nothing. Then we went around and just did a letter drop at all the factory outlets. Then we started getting more and more people contacting us and wanting to come in. So from there, it wasn't that the factory was using it as much as the workers there. They had their own little toys and hobbies. So they would come in. Once it went through them, they were involved in a club. Once it went to the club and they said, who done that? Then that brought more stuff in. I haven't advertised now for over 10 years.
John, you're not a young man anymore. Yet, as I look at you, you're very energetic. You're very vital. You've obviously got a lot of enthusiasm, not just for what you do, but life in general. So is your current engineering work something that you probably see going for quite a while, or is it something you would like to rein in?
I'm sort of thinking that probably from around about June, July, I might go back to a four-day week and start telling people I'm having every Friday off. And that way, if I want to go away for the weekend or do something, I can. And like I said, I'm not getting any younger, but I've always been fit and healthy. But I don't want to go and see things in a wheelchair. I want to be able to walk there and see what I'm seeing and do the things that I want to do. And my wife is 10 years younger than me, so she's going to be around a bit longer, and I want to make sure that we see them together.
I don't know about you, but certainly myself and certainly other people I've spoken to, when we were young, we saw people in their 60s, 70s plus as being over the hill, finished,
well,
done
were,
with.
They were back then when we were young because they didn't have the same levels of outlet for their sport, their entertainment or anything like that. It was very limited in what they did. And they were also in that sort of mood or that mode where they would go, got to get a job 5 days a week. I've got to pay the mortgage. I've got to do this. I've got to put food on the table. I've got to put the kids in school. You know, that was regimented. You hit 65, you get a gold watch and you sit back and you watch telly.
Yes.
You know, nowadays, that's gone out the window. And as you know, I got plenty of friends as well that are in their mid-70s that are still out playing on a weekend.
Still enjoying life.
They're not having a sook about it.
No.
They're just enjoying it.
Both a very healthy and a very encouraging thing for generations that are behind us coming up knowing that life doesn't stop at 65 or 70.
But it comes back to that old analogy of use it or lose it. And your brain is one of the biggest muscles in your body.
Yes.
Yeah. Once you sit there and start to stagnate, you will go downhill.
Positive attitude is really important, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm always looking at new things. One of the inventions that I've got there at the moment, and it's a medical biofeedback in kinesiology, is just something I'm putting together at the moment.
What, we're talking about something physical or?
Yeah, it's an actual machine that has computer program on it and everything, and got a PLC that runs all the diagnostics for it all, and it prints out a thing. You can ask you a question, and the pressure on your hands, as normal kinesiologists do, they put the pressure on the back of your hand, and they'll run through a set of questions, and they can tell by the resistance whether your body is rejecting the question, accepting the question, all that sort of stuff. Whereas what this does, it converts everything into a mechanical action, and it puts it out on the computer, and it's in milliseconds.
What would you like to do with it?
Oh, it'll go on the market and get sold eventually.
You are going to try and market it.
Yeah.
John, it's hard not to believe with the story of your life and where you are in your life that it won't happen. I quite believe it will. Short of you walking down the street to pick up a newspaper or bottled milk or something and a bus accidentally hitting you, you have got quite a few years left. I mean, once upon a time, 65, 70, people saw you over the hill. These days, it's quite easy to believe you've got another 20 plus years left. What would you like to achieve in that time? What would you want to do?
One of the things that I really want to do is, and it's a little bit sort of out there, is I want to make a flying motorcycle.
You have shared with us some pretty far out things. I've got to say, that's left field. What do you mean a flying motorcycle?
I want to be able to get on a motorbike that flies. A little bit like a Star Wars type thing. It won't be that shape, obviously.
No.
But the thing that's holding me back at the moment is the power source. I can build the thing, I can design it, I can do everything that has to be done, but the power source that drives the plates that actually run everything, we don't have that technology yet.
But quite conceivable in the next 20 years we will.
Yeah. So why dismiss something completely now when you can do the groundwork? So eventually I will do something else and change things around. Because you can buy some amazing little turbojet engines these days too.
Well, I hope I'm around in 20 years' time or even a little bit less to see.
If I did it with turbojet engines, I could do it tomorrow. A lot of money, but I can do it tomorrow.
Not John, our time is nearly up. You have achieved through your own desire, your own skills, your own learning, achieved quite a bit. If you were to sit in front of a group of young kids, let's say between 10 and 15 right now, given your experiences in life, would you have any advice for them?
Well, the main thing I think I would tell them is find something that you're good at, but you enjoy, and follow that. Follow it, because at the end of the day, if you take on engineering, and you just don't enjoy it, you're going to hate that job for the rest of your life. If you take on medicine and you hate it, you know, you're stuck in a job you hate. But if you like painting or if you like building motors, you love doing it, it's no stress on anything that you do. If you like music, pick up guitar, sing.
John, I think that is a fantastic way to end our talk together. Thank you very much for being on Listen to Older Voices.
No worries, thank you.
And to finish this program, we go out with a track called Call Me in the Morning, written and played by John Hanley.
Need you close. call me in the morning. Call me in the morning. You were here, my heart would sing. Praying one day you'll wear my ring. A broken heart is lying on the floor. I know you won't come knocking on my door, but won't you call me in the morning? Call me in the morning. I need you, girl. Call me in the morning. Let me hear you. Call me in the morning. One more time. Call me in the morning. Pick up the phone and call me in the
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Community Radio Network.